feeling like 2016 all over again. The Justice Department says Russia has been shelling out millions to far-right influencers here in the U.S.
They just want to throw sand in the gears of American democracy whenever they can.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Automakers are reassessing their plans for building more electric vehicles.
They see waning demand for EVs, but the thing is, there is a waning demand for cars and a lot of fossil cars.
And a movie lifts up the global debate around euthanasia. A library with nearly 2,000 copies of the same book. Plus, we meet a rapper from Portugal who's trying to confront toxic masculinity.
To have a real change, we need to change.
We meaning men.
Yeah, we men need to change.
Those stories and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for being here with us today.
The Biden administration is taking new steps against what it describes as a Russian disinformation campaign targeting the 2024 U.S. presidential election. On Wednesday, the Department of Justice announced the indictment of two state media employees at the Moscow broadcaster Russia Today for their alleged involvement.
Other reports point to Russia's Foreign Intelligence Agency, the SVR, alleging that its agents are on a mission to disrupt American politics in the weeks ahead of the November vote. Garrett Graff is a journalist and the director of cyber initiatives at the Aspen Institute.
We've seen a real flurry of activity, some expected, some unexpected this week, including Thursday afternoon. The Justice Department indicting a longtime Washington fixture named Dmitry Symes, who was the force behind a think tank in Washington called the Center for the National Interest, and was actually a foreign policy advisor on Donald Trump's first presidential campaign. The FBI had searched his Virginia estate a couple of weeks ago, so we had expected some sort of action from the Justice Department soon. Symes is believed to be in Russia and is probably outside the arms of U.S. law enforcement at this point.
So that's the latest from today, and this follows on another Justice Department announcement yesterday about the indictment of two state media employees at the broadcaster Russia Today. What does the DOJ say that they did?
Well, this has been part of a couple of different actions that we have seen the Justice Department take, effectively alleging Russia is continuing to meddle in U.S. politics and particularly the U.S. presidential election in the way that it has done now so many times. The Justice Department indictments this week go after an organization that's known as the Social Design Agency, a Russian company that is, sort of the successor to what in 2016 was known as the Internet Research Agency, and which was previously indicted by Special Counsel Robert Mueller for its interference in the 2016 presidential election. One of the big things that we saw come out this week was that actually millions of dollars had gone to fund pretty well-known brand name far-right U.S. right-wing influencers through a Tennessee company known as Tenant Media, and that some right-wing online influencers had been being paid as much as $400,000 a month for posting video content that aligned with Russian strategic and message goals. Now, those right-wing influencers say that they didn't know that the money that they were being paid was coming from Russia, but, the messages that they were sending were certainly pretty Russia-friendly.
There are also new reports about the SVR, Russia's Foreign Intelligence Agency. What do we know about their involvement?
Well, we have seen much of this work funneled through both the SVR and the Russian GRU. This is the Russian military intelligence and their foreign intelligence, sort of roughly the equivalent of their CIA. What I think we have seen is that Russia is continuing to fund and try to drive influence, particularly on the far right in U.S. politics, to aid Donald Trump and hurt Democratic candidates.
Why does the Kremlin prefer one presidential candidate over another? Is this about funding for the war in Ukraine?
It's almost always about Ukraine. This is an area where Vladimir Putin sees Donald Trump's return to the White House as being important to victory in Ukraine. More broadly, though, I think it's worth noting as well, Russia just wants to create chaos. You know, Russia just wants to undermine American faith in democracy. They want to undermine our trust in our politicians, and they want to make it look like democracy doesn't work very well. You know, they just want to throw sand in the gears of American democracy whenever they can.
Garrett Graff is a journalist and the director of cyber initiatives at the Aspen Institute.
The future of the global auto industry is electric, but there are speed bumps in the road ahead. Demand and EV infrastructure have yet to catch up, especially here in the U.S. It's getting automakers to reconsider some of their previous EV plans. Just this week, the Swedish brand Volvo announced that it's giving up on its goal of selling only electric vehicles by 2030. Felix Hammer is an EV expert and business consultant in Amsterdam. Let's start with this news from Volvo, Felix. How big of a surprise is it that the company's pulling back on plans to go 100% electric by the end of this decade? And why'd they put those plans in reverse?
I'm not that surprised, considering that they just announced last week the switch of not going full electric on their latest SUV, but actually also added the plug-in option. And I think it's sort of a reverse BMW, as I would like to call it, because you have this flexibility to put in whatever drivetrain in any car anyway. And that is actually what they announced that they will do, I think.
And BMW, the opposite of, because BMW said we can build an electric car and they did it?
Well, BMW does it the other way around because they have been introducing battery models for almost their full lineup. But then you can just get sort of whatever you want. If you want full petrol, many models are still available. If you want a plug-in, many models offer that too.
Has demand in Europe kind of plateaued? And if there is more of a market, what's preventing demand from growing bigger?
No, I don't think demand has plateaued at all. Because, for example, when you read about the growth slowing, this is actually not such a big of a concern. First of all, of course, if there's continuous growth, which there has been for so many years, it's sort of expected that the amount of growth maybe doesn't continue all the time at that speed. And then what we're seeing is that the biggest car market in Europe happens to be Germany. And in Germany, we can actually see a real slowdown, but that was sort of mainly caused by a very abrupt cut in subsidies that wasn't expected and wasn't announced. It was announced overnight.
There's this proposal in Germany right now that would see citizens get tax reductions for purchasing EVs. But generally, how impactful are those kinds of incentives?
I think they're huge. For example, could see earlier this year was that the market in Italy was, even for their normal numbers, unusually slow. But this was because everybody was waiting for this incentive to be unlocked. And then when it was gone in 24 hours or something like this. And you can really see that, yeah, this creates this unnatural wave. And in Belgium, there's now way better tax reduction on business cars. So suddenly the business fleet in Belgium is one of the fastest movers of all of Europe. And it hasn't been this way for many years.
Meanwhile, in Germany, Volkswagen is potentially closing down two factories in weak demand for EVs. What is happening with other automakers now? Are they getting ready to recalibrate their future EV projections as well? And how much does all that have to do with the muscular presence of Chinese EVs in Europe?
I mean, when you look at Volkswagen, they might tell the story this way, that they see waning demand for EVs. But the thing is, there is a waning demand for cars, and a lot of fossil cars aren't expected to be welcomed into many markets, especially looking forward to next year when the numbers of the fleet, what the CO2 can do in those fleets will be lowered. So actually, they need to close plants mainly because of fossil production, but that's not the way that they will tell the story.
So, Felix, on the infrastructure front, the U.S. is playing catch up in regard to charging infrastructure, charging stations, that kind of things for EVs. What is the story elsewhere, for example, in Europe, in Asia?
Yeah, in Europe and in Asia, especially, you can see spectacular differences. The thing with infrastructure is, of course, that first you need infrastructure to begin with electric vehicles. But when the infrastructure is in place, of course, there's also this matter of you have to be able to rely on it. The price needs to be right. So it is more than just the chargers. In Europe, we're getting very close to 1 million public plugs. But it's very region dependent still about reliability. Like, we're seeing better reliability figures in Germany than in France, but the pricing of charging is way better in France than in Germany. So there's a lot of factors that come into play.
Felix Hammer is an EV charging consultant and owner of the Electric Felix website. He joined us from Amsterdam.
Despite the gains made by women in rap and hip-hop, there's still a lot of toxic masculinity in the genre. Lots of songs objectify women or disrespect them, the videos too. In Portugal right now, there is one rapper taking his fellow artists to task for their behavior. The World's April PV picks up the story from here.
Preto is the artistic alter ego of Nuno Santos. From a young age, he recognized injustice by the way his mother was treated. A black woman originally from Cape Verde, now living in Portugal, cleaning and cooking for wealthy families.
Before I even heard about feminism and all that stuff, my mother was being a feminist for the way that she had three boys and the way she taught us to be strong men, but not to be men that impose their strength with violence. Taught us to respect women.
Preto noticed how his mom was subjected to racism and sexism, not only from her employers, but from government officials as well. The family lived in a poor section of Lisbon, an area often raided by police. Despite his mom's long working hours, Preto says she took the time to teach some important lessons. Respect for women is reflected in his music, and he's not afraid to rap about it, and ask some hard questions for other men to answer.
What is love? What is this hypermasculinity love that uses women and bodies as objects?
Preto addresses these issues in songs like this one, Amor de Uber. He raps about how he doesn't want an Uber romance, where women are picked up and dropped off. In Portugal, like most countries around the globe, machismo is seen as strength. Preto says that's got to change.
To have a real change, we need to change.
We meaning men.
Yeah, we men need to change.
When I met Preto, he was wearing a black t-shirt, wool cap, shaggy beard, and tattoos up and down his arms. A classic rapper getup. But he raps about the dangers of toxic masculinity, and he isn't afraid to cry. But Preto has an idea. Boys and men can start at home.
My family is, most of it, matriarchal, so we have a lot of aunties and now a lot of cousins, women, and now a lot of nieces. And we, of course, we're trying to have this dialogue and understand also what are their fears and how they're living this current world, the pressure.
A pressure both men and women feel. And Preto says men need to talk about it more. For The World, I'm April Peavy, Lisbon.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Paul Salopek has literally been walking around the world since 2013. He's been following the pathways of our ancestors who fanned out across the globe from Africa during the Stone Age, from Ethiopia to the Middle East, through Turkey into Asia, across India and Myanmar, and on to Paul's most recent walking journey through China. For these past 11 years, Salopek's been posting about his experiences of traveling the world on foot for National Geographic, meeting people, taking photos, and making videos like this one. Paul, thanks for joining us again.
It's good to be with you, Marco.
So once again, there's an experience you can really have only by traveling at the speed of one step, as you are. You gave this video a title, A King of Song in Southwestern China Offers a Musical Tour of His Village and Culture. Tell us about the singer and what he's singing about here.
Yeah, this is Mr. Li Genfang, and he's a community leader in an ethnic Bai minority village in the province of Yunnan in southwestern China. There are about 2 million Bai. They're one of, 26 different ethnic groups in this province. It's the most ethnically diverse province in China. It's kind of a crossroads between Southeast Asia, Tibet, and western China. And this group of people, the Bai, are famous in China for their singing.
Yeah, and that relationship of the Bai people to song and the range of emotions they express in the music. I'd like us to hear another example. This is also Li Yanfang singing a very different kind of song. Yeah, very different sort of expression. What's going on there?
You can probably intuit what's going on between these two songs, right? So one was a love song, the first one. The Bai believe that the heart and the liver are kind of love organs. The first one was saying something like, I love you with all my liver.
Wow.
And then the second one was basically a song from another partner who's saying, shut up. It's kind of an angry song saying, don't sing to me anymore. And Mr. Li said that we're kind of shy, introverted people. We don't really communicate very well, kind of verbally, you know, but through conversation. But we get our emotions out through song. And so they have this enormously complex repertoire of songs about culture, songs about personal feelings, songs about work, songs about religion, songs about history. It's kind of an encyclopedic musical tradition that the Bai have. Very complex.
So how much of the Bai people singing is performance and how much of it is like personal and even maybe practical communication?
It's all of the above. That's what's so kind of remarkable about it. And anthropologists have gone there to study Bai singing. There's polyphonic singing between men and women that can be flirtatious and actually can be X-rated, which is deeply personal, of course. There's kind of a ceremonial song done at funerals. There are songs that kind of celebrate communities. You know, when I was walking through these hills, these green hills of southwestern Yunnan, and coming into Bai communities, they are kind of quiet, actually. They're, you know, people are kind of minding their own business, going up and down the alleyways. But occasionally you hear these bursts of music coming from people's lungs. And Mr. Li, when he sings, he would spread his feet wide, he'd throw out his chest, hold his hands down by his hips like a gunslinger, and just extrude this extraordinary human sound that had this enormous range. It really is an amazing thing to see and listen to.
And quite beautiful.
We're speaking with National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek. Another subject you wrote about, Paul, a Westerner who traveled the same mountain paths a century ago, a self-trained botanist and anthropologist named Joseph Rock. Who was he?
Joseph Rock, what a character. Almost lost to history, but revived by writers like Bruce Chatwin, who found him fascinating. He's a cranky, cantankerous botanist born in Austria in the late 19th century to a butler who's the son of a butler. And he basically escaped a miserable childhood in Europe that had, you know, hierarchical, almost feudal social structures and ended up in remote southwestern China collecting plants for the U.S. Agricultural Department. He was originally sent there, self-taught botanist. He had a secondary school education to find blight-resistant chestnut trees. But what he ended up doing is everything else. He collected thousands of plants, hundreds of animals. He helped identify 700 species of rhododendron. And then even more extraordinary is he learned local languages and became one of the crucial chroniclers of these threatened cultures in southwestern China. He basically spent 30 plus years riding horses and being carried in a litter, turning himself, Marco, basically from kind of a butler's son in Europe into kind of a knight or a prince in another feudal society, this time in China, being carried in a litter through these mountain passes and documenting their culture, their religion, their belief systems, their script. And he did this to such a degree that his work is canonical. Anthropologists today even consult Joseph Rock's work.
And getting carried around like that, as you were saying, and that's like in those old sedans, like Marie Antoinette would have been carried around in, right?
He was a strange character. I mean, on the one hand, he was deeply empathetic with the indigenous people of the mountains of Western China. And he was, you know, he kind of saw himself as a defender of their culture. On the other hand, he was kind of a man of his time. He had racist attitudes to mainstream Chinese. He didn't like cities. He hated modern life. He kind of had this romantic orientalist version of Asia. He hated his botanical competitors. He hated his editors at National Geographic, for whom he wrote articles. He had lots of grudges, Dr. Rock. And he also carried around weapons. And at sunset, he would fire his Colt pistols into the air, ostensibly to chase away bandits, but I think it was just a power trip for him. Complicated guy.
Yeah, well, as you point out, he also wrote for National Geographic, clearly taking a very different approach from yours to telling people's stories.
Yeah.
What's interesting, you mentioned Rock in several of your articles. It's like you kept crossing paths with this guy from a century ago. What did it feel like to be visiting some of the same places, meeting people who could have been the great-grandchildren of people Rock wrote about?
This corner of the planet, this corner of the world, is so extraordinarily beautiful. It's one of the most physically beautiful landscapes that I've walked through on this long walking project. 18,000 foot peaks covered by snow, the color of lavender in the distance, spruce and pine forests, you know, bursting with mushrooms and wildflowers and big rivers the color of jade. It's bewitching. And I think that it even bewitched me a little bit.
And it's no surprise that outside writers, non-Chinese writers and non-Chinese filmmakers used Rock's work for the basis for the Shangri-La legend, right? The Lost Horizon book that came out in the 1930s, this kind of utopian world of kind of quasi-Tibetan people who live forever. This is where it came from. And Joseph Rock brought it to the outside world.
Again, through this very romantic prism.
Wow.
And so imagine, Marco, that you've passed over this snowy mountain pass. There are Tibetan prayer flags that are crystallized with ice flapping under a pale sun. And the wind is as sharp as razor blades. It's so cold. And you look down into a sunlit valley, and there are the domes of a Buddhist monastery kind of shining in the sun. That is Muli. That is the place where Rock's heart lay. Sadly for Rock, he had to leave China after the revolution of 49. He ended up in Hawaii as kind of a retired scholar, where according to his obituary, he died alone. He had no family. He never married, far away from this land that he loved so much.
Wow, what a story. We have lots of pictures and links to stories Paul posted of his journey through China. They're at outofedenwalk.nationalgeographic.org and at our website, theworld.org. Paul, as always, thank you very much.
It's a great pleasure to be with you, Marco.
You're listening to The World.
It's not easy to contemplate what your final days might look like, but it could help you figure out where you land on a long simmering global debate.
Allowing yourself to think about what you would want at the end is a way of understanding this controversy.
More on the questions around euthanasia and assisted death, that story's ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Some terrible news out of Kenya today. The Ugandan Olympic runner, Rebecca Cheptegei, has died. She was attacked over the weekend by her boyfriend. Cheptegei was a long-distance and mountain running champion. She's also not the first female runner to be killed in Kenya. Her death has drawn attention and anger to the country's troubles around violence against women. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gakandi reports from Nairobi.
Just last month, 33-year-old Ugandan runner Rebecca Cheptegei was running the marathon at the Paris Olympics. She had only recently returned to her home in western Kenya, where she lived and trained. On Sunday, she went to church with her children. When she came back home, according to local media, her partner attacked her and set her on fire. Doctors said 80% of her body was covered in burns. Today, after fighting for her life at the hospital, she succumbed to her injuries. Dr. Kimani Mbugua told local media she died of multi-organ failure.
We supported the organs as best as we could, but unfortunately, it was beyond what we could do.
Cheptegei's family has been speaking to local media in Kenya. On a TV broadcast today, they gathered outside of the hospital where Cheptegei was being treated. Her sister sobs and her mother shakes her head. She was a good child with no issues, her mother said. I don't know what to do. This case has put Kenya in the international spotlight. Jackson Tuwe, who heads Kenya Athletics, addressed the media this week.
The kind of things that we are seeing, we have seen them in the past. It's a very sad situation. Let us pray for that lady, for that athlete.
Cheptegei's murder is drawing comparisons to Kenyan runner Agnes Chirop, who was also killed by her partner in 2021. Kenya's female politicians have been raising the alarm this week. Gloria Arobwa is a local senator.
Women of this country cannot continue being ignored. You know, how many athletes till today do we know of whose cases are still pending in court? 6, 7, even 10 years later. Yet we know the perpetrators.
Earlier this year, thousands of women across Kenya took to the streets to protest against the rising cases of domestic violence and femicide. Senator Agnes Kivindu has called on the president to act on it.
I don't see how one can just kill a person. If you are fed up with us, just leave us alone. Walk your way. Don't kill us. Don't kill our daughters. Leave them alone. Let them live. They have a future.
While domestic violence impacts women of all backgrounds in Kenya, activists say female athletes like Cheptegei are particularly vulnerable because of the earnings they get from the sport. Cheptegei's father suggested that may have played a role in his daughter's murder. She had bought land here, he told local media, and he added it had become a point of conflict for her and her partner. The alleged killer is also being treated for burn wounds at the same hospital where Cheptegei died. The government needs to bring justice for my daughter, he says. He adds that she was a breadwinner for the family. Her death is a major loss for all of them. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi, Nairobi.
Armenia and Azerbaijan have been at odds for decades. They fought multiple wars since the waning days of the Soviet Union. Despite this fraught relationship, the two countries are now talking about their common border, about reopening diplomatic relations, and about the right of return for Armenians who fled one disputed region. If you ask people in Armenia, though, many are not happy with how these conversations are going. As The World's Daniel Offen reports from the capital, Yerevan, the face of that opposition now belongs to a man of the cloth.
His name is Bagrat Galstanyan. He's an archbishop in the Armenian Apostolic Church. In recent months, he's become a political force. Galstanyan's rise as a political leader began in Tavush, a region in northern Armenia where he was the chief bishop. In April, as part of the peace negotiation process, Armenia ceded 4 villages in the Tavush region to Azerbaijan. Galstanyan opposed this move. He saw it as capitulation to Azerbaijan. So he started a movement called Tavush for the Homeland. And in the spring, he and his supporters marched south to Yerevan.
Nikol Pashinyan, meng jam zhamanak unenk razorakan nerkayatsnelu.
Tens of thousands of protesters gathered in Yerevan's Republic Square. Galstanyan called on the Prime Minister, Nikol Pashinyan, to resign. He said, "You no longer have any power in Armenia." The protesters chanted, "Nikol, go away," and Nikol is a traitor. One of Galstanyan's top grievances with the government is the way they've negotiated with Azerbaijan.
Armenia is not negotiating anything with Azerbaijan. There is no negotiations. Azerbaijan is telling Armenia is doing. We have to bring real negotiations on the table with the involvement of international mediators and guarantors.
Galstanyan has organized protests and rallies all around Armenia. In June, things took a turn. During a rally led by Galstanyan, police deployed stun grenades against protesters. More than 100 people were injured. The government says protesters were attempting to storm the parliament building and that the police's response was legal and professional. Here's what Galstanyan says.
They decided to bombard the people It was peaceful movement. It was peaceful demonstration. So June 12th is the total delegitimization of this government. They have proven that they have no connection with the people.
Galustanyan doesn't mince words when talking about Pashinyan's government. He referred to him as a dictator, as an illegitimate leader, and he's called on him to resign. But Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan is still in power. Peace negotiations with Azerbaijan are ongoing, and the protests led by Galustanyan have died down.
This is a national movement with spiritual aspect. The solutions should be political, because this government has lost legitimacy, and they are not representing our national ideas and dreams.
Galustanyan has announced that he plans to run for prime minister in the next election, but that he wouldn't stay in that position for long. He said that he would form a transitional government and then set up new elections.
It hasn't been my desire. I could have been spiritual guarantor of this movement, nothing more. But I understand that there is a huge need. We cannot just lose it. I don't want to use big words like sacrifice. I've just presented myself as a channel, as an agent of change.
In recent weeks, Galustanyan has been back in Yerevan speaking at rallies. He has an imposing look, a graying beard, a church robe, and a booming voice. This rally is taking place near St. Anna Church in the heart of the city. Attendance is relatively low compared to prior protests, just a few hundred people. But those who are here are Galustanyan's strongest supporters.
What was very special about Archbishop, that he was able to unite people who had very different political views and visions for the country. However, everyone understands that where this government is leading our country is not in our best interest.
This is Kate Tairian, a doctor visiting from Canada, an active member of the Armenian diaspora, and a staunch Galustanyan supporter. She's been going to his rallies all summer while visiting Armenia.
Our country needs a crisis management. Our country needs a transitional government. And there has to be a process that is transparent and people trust in someone. And I think he is that kind of leader.
In recent months, leading opposition figures have endorsed Galustanyan's movement, but many are skeptical and don't see him as a viable political leader. Benjamin Pagosyan, who's with the Applied Policy Research Institute of Armenia, says that Galustanyan faces an uphill battle.
The issue is that Bagrat Galustanyan is not a politician. He is a part of Armenian clergy. And this is a problem because even Bagrat Galustanyan is telling that this movement is not pure political. This is movement to bring back our traditional values, justice, truth. All these are very good things. But I don't see the movement fully political, and definitely Archbishop Galustanyan is not a politician.
Pagosyan says being a political outsider will make it harder for Galustanyan to tackle the key issues that most Armenians care about, such as national security, the peace process with Azerbaijan, or economic development. Tigran Grigoryan is the head of the Regional Center for Democracy and Security. He says that there's also the problem of political engagement in Armenia.
There's a huge political apathy in the country. About 70% of the population doesn't support either the opposition or the government.
And because of that, Grigoryan says it will be difficult for the archbishop to compete with the sitting government. Galustanyan's supporters, though, have embraced his vision and hope that he remains a force who can shake up Armenian politics. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman, Yerevan, Armenia.
And now a few things in the news you might have missed.
A big fireball in the sky over Luzon Island in the Philippines appeared yesterday when an asteroid disintegrated safely in the Earth's atmosphere.
This was unusual because we knew it was coming even before it arrived. That's only happened 9 times ever in the history of astronomy, even though asteroids do enter our atmosphere about once every 2 weeks.
And on another space story, NASA is gearing up to bring the Boeing Starliner home. The craft has been in space since June and is expected to land early Saturday morning in New Mexico. The astronauts who caught a ride to the International Space Station on the Starliner, though, they will not be aboard.
Yeah, Butch Wilmore and Suni Williams are expected to be biding time in space until February, making what was supposed to be an 8-day trip about 8 months long. NASA says they've got more than enough supplies to last for the duration of their stay.
Finally, a fish species from Asia known as the lionfish has made its way to Florida, where its population has grown out of control because it has no natural predators. An annual competition organized by Florida's Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission sends divers out with spears to hunt the striped orange and white creatures because they threaten Florida's reefs. They also have dramatic-looking spikes known to cause painful injuries.
Whoever catches the most lionfish wins. This year's competition just wrapped up. One competitor caught more than 900 of them at last count.
And those are a few things you might have missed in the news. A new movie by Spanish director Pedro Almodovar has rekindled the global debate around euthanasia. The film is called The Room Next Door. One of the main characters, played by Tilda Swinton, is battling cancer. Her close friend, portrayed by Julianne Moore, accompanies her through her final weeks of life. Almodovar says about Moore's character,
es una mujer que escribe sobre la muerte, pero no acaba de aceptar.
She writes about death but cannot accept it. The director has weighed in on this debate himself, saying that there should be the possibility to have euthanasia all over the world. It should be regulated and a doctor should be allowed to help his patient, he said. Margaret Batten has spent a lot of time trying to understand the ethics around end-of-life decisions. She explores how different cultures handle these issues in her book, Ending Life. We spoke earlier today, and I started by asking her why she thought this film got an 18-minute standing ovation at the Venice Film Festival this week.
This is a universal topic. Every single person dies, and often the people near them, the ones who care about them, are unable to act in the way that's portrayed in this film. So even if they would like to, the perceived risks of doing so can be acute.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that everybody would want to act in this same way, and there's lots of opposition. But the sense of wanting to help a person who is clearly already facing death is huge, huge. No wonder there's 18 minutes of applause.
Mm. Can you remind us where in the world is assisted death legal or partially legal?
I'm glad you said assisted death. Sometimes this is called euthanasia, as it often is in Europe. In the U.S., it is never called that. In fact, it is legally designated as not suicide and not euthanasia. But here's just a little quick list of the countries where it is currently legal. New Zealand, Australia, most of it, Spain, Colombia, Canada. In the U.S., there are about 10 states plus the District of Columbia, Belgium, Ecuador, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, Portugal, Austria, Germany, and Switzerland.
Hmm.
It's a pretty long list, isn't it?
It is a pretty long list, but it is, you know, still a small minority of countries. And I'm wondering if you can tell us about how this debate about end of life sounds different in different cultures, maybe in places where it is legal and places where it's not.
Often how it sounds will be reflected against background cultures, whether the country is, say, Catholic in background or Muslim in background or something else in background. Religious requirements and teachings have been playing a pretty substantial role in the opposition, typically.
Right. Catholic groups, among others, oppose assisted death. So do some disability groups who say, you know, it's ripe for abuse.
Yep. There's no evidence of abuse, certainly not in the U.S. anyway, that I'm aware of.
Mm.
That doesn't mean it doesn't happen. So some studies, at least some older studies I'm aware of, suggest physicians, as many as a third or a quarter of them, have been asked for help. A smaller percentage provide help, but they do so discreetly.
You named some countries that have just recently passed laws to allow for assisted death. I'm wondering how the conversation has evolved over the years around the world about assisted death.
Until about 1850, the ways in which we died were of parasitic and infectious diseases. And those diseases often dispatched their victims relatively quickly. So the phenomenon of a prolonged death from a disease or condition with a long downhill course, like many forms of heart or circulatory disease, and also cancer and other diseases like ALS and so on, those resulted in death much more quickly, or death was caused by other conditions. And it's not until after the development of antibiotics and public sanitation, many other factors that allow us to die much more protracted deaths. Now, that's a good thing in a way, right? That is, we get more time, but we also get a much longer period of dying. And it's that long period of dying that many people would prefer to cut the very tail end of.
Yeah. We're talking about this topic right now because of this film that has, reignited debate over assisted death. And I'm wondering how you, as someone who's been steeped in this topic for decades, interpret the conversations that come out of these types of pop culture moments. Do you think that this is helpful to continuing a conversation about this?
I think it can be uncomfortable for some people, but we have practices, cultural traditions that developed maybe in the Middle Ages, still governing when death was unpredictable and rapid, and there was nothing much you could do about it. Now, still operative in a world in which death, at least in privileged countries, is a long, long protracted affair. That's a big difference.
Philosopher, medical ethicist, and author Margaret Peggy Batten. She's also a professor at the University of Utah.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. You might not have given it much thought, but there's a debate raging in the museum world about the ethics of when or if it's okay to display human remains. Often this discussion has revolved around the remains of indigenous people or those of enslaved black people. The conversation also includes the treatment of bodies for people mummified in ancient Egypt. Last winter, The World's Sarah Birnbaum sent us this story after visiting a museum in Sydney, Australia, grappling with the ethics of displaying mummies.
I'm at the Chow Chuck Wing Museum at the University of Sydney, and curator Melanie Pitkin is showing me around.
So this is the mummy room, and we're standing in front of the mummified complete body and coffin of Marua.
The body is wrapped in linen. It's lying in a painted coffin without a lid, and above the coffin is a wall-mounted LED screen showing CT scans of the mummy.
So you can see the visualizations reconstructed from the CT scan technology, so looking beneath the wrappings.
We go over to a glass case up against the back wall with unwrapped mummified body parts in it, including the legs of a small child. The display tells the story of the antiquities trade in the 19th century.
There was a practice, particularly from the Victorian era, where travellers would go to Egypt and take back souvenirs in the form of body parts, which was quite a big trade at this time in history.
These body parts won't be on show for long. The museum will also be renaming the mummy room. Eternity room is one option. Pitkin says the word mummy has too many negative connotations.
And this very much goes back to the way human remains are being shown in cinema and film and all that type of domain, popular culture.
Over the past few years, museums in Europe, North America, Australia, and New Zealand have moved away from the term mummy to emphasize they were once living people. The preferred term is mummified person or mummified remains. And some museums are questioning whether it's appropriate to display ancient corpses in the first place.
If we go back to ancient Egypt, the mummified body was never supposed to be seen. It was supposed to be buried, interred, and left there for eternity.
Across town at the Australian Museum, archaeologist Fran Dory is the head of exhibitions. The museum has two wrapped mummies in their collection, and one of them is on display. Dory says the main complaint she gets from visitors about the mummies is, "I don't think that's what the person would have wanted." But she says that's far from obvious. Ancient Egyptians craved immortality.
You can't impose your viewpoint on something that's 4,000 years old either, or a culture that's so distant from our own. So you have to be really careful about looking back in the past and going, well, I think that they wouldn't have liked that. It's like, can you do that? Can you think about that? I don't know.
It's not even clear whose voice should count. The ancient Egyptians? Scholars? Curators? Museum goers? Modern Egyptians? For what it's worth, museums in Egypt have mummies on display. At the National Museum of Egyptian Civilization in Cairo, there's a royal mummy hall where Tutankhamun and Ramses II are wrapped from their neck to their feet, but with their faces exposed. Also, the Egyptian government hasn't asked any foreign museums to give mummified remains back. But not all Egyptians are on the same page. Abir El-Adani is an Egyptian Egyptologist working in the UK.
I think it is impossible to speak on behalf of all the Egyptian population. Everybody will have their own opinion.
For her, mummified remains deserve respect. A museum should think long and hard before putting them on display.
I believe that museums need to think about the ethics behind displaying mummified remains from ancient Egypt, including the reasons for display and also the interpretation as well.
And there's a lot to think about. Should the mummies be wrapped or unwrapped? Are fragments okay or just whole bodies? Should they be in a coffin? Does a coffin need to be sealed? One German museum won't display bodies at all, even if they're wrapped. A museum in the UK has wrapped mummies but no CT scans because they're too invasive. There's no consensus. Melanie Pitkin at Sydney's Chow Chuck Wing Museum says after a long process of consultation, they've decided to remove the body parts but keep the wrapped mummies and CT scans on display for now. The museum might make other changes down the line.
We need to detach ourselves from the way things have been done before and get people to challenge and question, you know, who we're seeing, why we're seeing them, and how we're referring to them.
It's about getting visitors to see mummies not as monsters or objects of curiosity, she says, but as people. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum, Sydney.
One of the many reasons why I love libraries is the variety of books you can find there. You always stumble on something new or unexpected.
There's one library, though, that's turning that idea on its head. It has 1,984 copies of the same book. The book, 1984, by George Orwell, published in 1949.
75 years on, it still has a punch that many other books maybe don't.
Hans K. Clausen is the Scottish artist behind the 1984 library. It's named after the main character in the dystopian novel, the Winston Smith Library of Victory and Truth.
It was launched, it was first seen in public in Jura, in the Jura Village Hall.
Jura is a small island off the western coast of Scotland. It's where Orwell lived near the end of his life while he wrote 1984.
The library is actually a mobile one, now on tour, making stops in Edinburgh, London, and Paris. When the tour ends, though, Clausen wants the copies to return home.
My kind of ambition would be that we build a bespoke library in Jura, near where he wrote it, and it becomes both a destination for people who go to Jura because of the Orwell connection, but also it would become a centre for creativity.
Clausen says he can see his 1984 library hosting residencies for artists and writers. It could also be a venue for events that tap into themes from Orwell's work. Clausen says the official Orwell Foundation supports the idea.
Now, though, comes the hard part. He's currently working on finding a permanent location for the library and a way to attract funding for it.
And we wrap things up today on that double plus good note. Thank you, George Orwell, for that line. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for listening, and we will see you back here tomorrow.
From PRX.